Okay, page 119. We're talking about the precision of the mitzvos. And we're on page 119, little paragraph 2. We pointed out that for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, there's a certain science to the precision of the mitzvos, such that it resonates with all of physical reality as far as the precision in nature. Just like in chemistry and in physics, you need to have, in order for the elements and in order for all of the compound materials that we find in the world to have their integrity, they have to be combined in exactly certain proportions. So too, in the spiritual realm, mitzvah performance has to be prescribed with exact precision in order for the mitzvah to have its efficacy, in order for it to have its intended benefit. And so he really spells that out in subparagraph number 2 on page 119. So we need a volunteer for today. Alina, you want to read? Page 119, we're at the little paragraph number 2. The same attention to detail.
The same attention to detail is prevalent in all of nature. Each physical object is made up of a combination of different elements, combined according to very exact specifications. The proportions must be more precise than the mind can fathom. Mm-hmm. Even if the smallest error was made in the proportion of these elements, the object would no longer exist as it is. The plant, animal, or limb in question would be defective or would not exist at all.
Now remember, he's speaking in the medieval period when there are only four elements on the periodic table. You know, there's earth, wind, fire, and water. In the modern periodic table, what number are we up to? Who's a chemistry major?
100 and something.
At least. Yeah. So not only that, but we understand what molecular structure is, and we know that just adding an additional atom to a molecule changes it from being H2O to hydrogen peroxide, from water to a completely different material. So even without knowing all of the things that we know about the complexity of chemistry, we can appreciate what Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is saying, but it's even more appreciable when we consider the complexity of the chemical makeup of everything that's around us. It's one of the benefits of studying science. I wish I had studied more science, but one of the benefits is being able to see the great precision of the Creator in the world that he presented to us. And that's really, for many of the great Rishonim, the great medievalists, this is a virtuous endeavor, is to study science in order to be able to appreciate the parallels that exist between the physical world and the spiritual realm, and also the great wisdom and the great complexity of Hashem, who has created all of this. And the more that you study, the more that you can appreciate the great benevolence of Hashem, the great balance that he's created with the tremendous complexity and the great difficulty involved in creating the perfect balance that can sustain life, and so forth. So anyway, what he's basically saying is that the parallel exists between the physical reality, the physical world, and the mitzvah world, or the spiritual world of mitzvah performance. Please continue.
The Torah also records how the sacrificial animal is to be cut into pieces and how to arrange each piece, and which parts of the body are to be eaten and which are to be burnt on the altar. Specific categories of people are designated to eat, burn, and bring the animal to the altar, and they may not be substituted.
Who is he referring to? What specific categories of people is he referring to?
The Kohanim.
The Kohanim, right? If you're not a Kohen, you can't do the Avodah. You can't do this service in the temple. So there's a certain correlation between your pedigree and your ability to perform, to have a certain effect through the performance of the mitzvah. So two people can do the exact same act, and for one person it's considered to be to create a virtuous phenomenon in the spiritual realm. And if a non-Kohen tries to do the exact same thing, what happens? He gets a punishment, and the karban is completely invalid. So why should that be? Two same acts. So it's not just actually the physical act that creates the effect. It's the physical act combined with the neshama of the individual who is doing that act that creates the efficacy. So it gets even more complex, you see, in how this works. Yeah.
After a discussion last week where you presented the two different ideas. Where the Rambam says that it's the fact that we're commanded that gives us the reason to do the mitzvah.
Yes.
I was thinking that don't we know that the Avos kept the Torah and they weren't commanded to keep the mitzvot? But as I understand, they intuited the inherent value in keeping the mitzvot. So
for Rabbi Yehuda Levi, that works out great, right?
Exactly. So
yes.
I'm saying, I wonder how...
You wonder how the Rambam would be able to reconcile that.
I'm sure he knew that.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's an excellent point. It is an excellent point that you're raising. What would the Rambam do with the Gemara that says that the Avos fulfilled all the mitzvahs in the Torah? We've touched a little bit on it in the past. You know, when Chazal say that they observed all the mitzvahs, does that mean, you know, like it's like the famous question, how do you know that Moshe Rabbeinu wore a shtreimel? So the answer is, what, you think Moshe Rabbeinu wouldn't wear a shtreimel? That's the answer. You know, how do you know that Moshe Rabbeinu ate kishka on Shabbos? Moshe Rabbeinu wouldn't eat kishka? The image, we all create gods in our own image, in a sense. When we go back, you know, like my children have books about the great Tanoim, like Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and the little children's illustration books that come from Eretz Yisrael have Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai depicted as a Yerushalmi chassid wearing a shtreimel and a long abekesha, right? Which is great, because for the child to get that image, it really helps the child associate with, I'm not being critical, I'm just saying that we sometimes create those images in our mind to sort of be able to create that association with our past. I don't know necessarily that when Chazal say that the Avos performed all the mitzvahs, that they performed them in the exact same way that you and I fulfill the mitzvahs. In other words, the Zohar says that when Yaakov Avinu wanted to fulfill the mitzvah of tefillin, do you know what Yaakov's pair of tefillin looked like? The Zohar says that it wasn't really a pair of tefillin, it was the maklos, it was the speckled rods. That was Yaakov Avinu's pair of tefillin. So what does that mean? I haven't the foggiest idea what it means. I don't know what it means. I don't understand the association between the speckled rods that Yaakov placed in front of the sheep when they were in heat and to the mitzvah of tefillin. I have no understanding of that. But at least what you do see from the Zohar is the idea that sometimes you have to be a little bit imaginative, you know, creative in trying to understand what Chazal mean when they say that the Avos fulfilled the entire Torah.
My only point was that there must be some inherent value in keeping the mitzvos as opposed to just being obliged. Because
yes, the Rambam agrees to that. We made a very important point of stating that. When it comes to the 613 mitzvos, the Rambam feels that there is an inherent value in each one of the 613 mitzvos. It's the details that he takes issue with. Why an esrog and not a lemon? Right? That was the example. Is there virtue in taking minim of species of that grow by the water and shaking them before God to show your appreciation of the gift of water on the festival of water? Absolutely. But the Rambam might take issue with why the specificity of dafka, these four species, you understand? So that's the Avos, yes, they had an appreciation for the mitzvos because there is inherent value for everybody, even according to the Rambam. Yeah, whether or not it's the same tefillin or the same matzah, or, you know, so that's the debate between Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and the Rambam. Okay, good. Okay, yes. Yes, please.
The Torah also describes the physical requirements of those involved, and even requires that there be no defect in their adornments or clothing. This applies especially to the Kohen Gadol, who had permission to enter the Chamber of Divinity, in which the Divine Presence, the Ark, and the Torah were located.
So it gets even more complex. Not only do you have to be a Kohen in order for your neshama to interact with the physical act that you're doing, but the Gemara explains, and this is really inherent in the Torah, if a Kohen goes into the Beis HaMikdash without his vestments, without the special Big Day Kahuna, without the special garments of the Kohen, then what is the effect? The effect is that the Avoda is completely invalid. So now we've added an additional layer of complexity. I have to take a garment that is manufactured in a very, very specific way, with plaited threads made of linen and wool, dyed in a certain fashion, And only when I'm wearing that set of garments, and I'm a Kohen, and I cut the animal into specific parts and place them in specific places on the Mizbeach, and I give other portions of the animal to be consumed by the bringer of the Korban, does it work? Otherwise, it just doesn't work. Yeah?
That's no different than a surgeon or a dental surgeon. It's got to be done the right way with the right tools, wearing the right clothes with the right person, or it's not going to work. There'll be harm done.
Right, right. It's a very good analogy. That's what he's saying. Although one could argue, what does it matter what color the scrubs are?
No.
Okay. But here it does. Here it does. So there's even more specificity. You know, so I was just, the reason I asked you about the color of the scrubs, I was just speaking to someone the other day who manufactures scrubs, and he explained to me that different hospitals have different colors and different staff people of the hospital have different color scrubs so that they can distinguish a nurse from an orderly or surgeon, right, and know the difference between the two. So there it's a matter of protocol, it's a matter of creating some ability to distinguish from the others, but Rabbi Yehuda Levi is saying there's an inherent value in the color blue in the thread of the Kohen's garment, right?
Although within that hospital, those colors do matter.
Right, but they could still be arbitrary. Some fellow in the management decided that the nurses would wear red and the doctors would wear green.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Continue, please.
Special instructions are given pertaining to his holiness and purification and their various gradations, and his requisite prayers. All the details would take too long to mention. But each and every one is based on the written Torah and on that which our sages recorded, the oral law, all originating from God's words to Moshe.
Okay. Continue, please.
Similarly, the specifications for the entire tabernacle were shown to Moshe on Mount Sinai. The tabernacle, the tent of meeting, the shewbread table, the menorah, the ark, the tabernacle courtyard, its pillars, its covers, and all the procedures of the tabernacle. They were all shown to Moshe on a spiritual plane, but in such a way that he would understand the physical dimensions as they were commanded.
Okay, so if you take a look at footnote 151, Rashi actually cites this in from a Medrash. Rashi says that Moshe was puzzled. He didn't know how to figure out how to manufacture the menorah. And there are a few places in the words of Chazal where our sages tell us that Moshe was puzzled and he didn't understand how he was supposed to make something for the Mishkan. They say it for the machatzis shekel, for the half shekel. Moshe didn't understand it. And Moshe also didn't understand how to manufacture the menorah. There are a number of commentaries that ask the question, because basically what the Medrash says is that God had to show Moshe an image of menorah made out of fire for him to sort of have a blueprint from which he could work in order to manufacture the menorah. So what is it that puzzled Moshe so greatly that he couldn't get it until Hashem showed him an illustration of it in fire from heaven? This really is what Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is using to support his contention that the physical plane is really directly correlates with the spiritual plane, and that everything that exists in the physical plane and the way that we interact with it directly affects the spiritual realm. It affects the fabric of the spiritual fabric of the cosmos. And the way that it does that is because when you manufacture a menorah in a very, very specific way, and you light it, and you do it in the Beis HaMikdash or in the Mishkan via a Kohen, it creates some kind of benefit or some kind of connection that creates some elevation in the fabric of the universe. That's what puzzled Moshe. What puzzled Moshe is, in general, how does our physical behavior create this kind of change or transformation within the spiritual realm? How is it that we as puny human beings, by the small acts that we do, how does that change what's going on in a much more real sense in the world above us? And so ultimately, what Rabbi Yehuda Levi takes a proto-Kabbalistic view, sort of like a pre-Kabbalistic view to the world around us. Everything that exists in the physical world is a facade for something much deeper, and everything is connected to a spiritual parallel entity that we don't see. But what we do know is that every time we do something according to the prescription of the Torah, we're creating some kind of positive change. And that's what was puzzling to Moshe, and until Hashem showed him, you know, Moshe, that menorah that I want you to build out of gold, there is a corresponding menorah in my realm where I reside. And so every time you light that menorah down below, that ignites the menorah that exists up here. And that's why it's important for you to do. Every time you say a word of tefillah, it may be just words down below, but it triggers some kind of words that occur up above. As a matter of fact, we say this every day in our davening without even being aware of it. You know, do you know what I'm referring to? When in our tefillah, what we actually acknowledge is that whenever we daven, we're actually prompting the angels above to be able to pray to Hashem. There's a Gemara that says that until we recite the Shema every morning and we say Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, the angels up high cannot say their words of devotion to Hashem, which are Kadosh, 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 Hashem Tzevakos, Melech Al Haaretz Kevodo. They need to actually wait for us to say our affirmation of faith before they can recite their words of worship to Hashem in the heavens. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Does it not also work the opposite way, that if we commit Nevera, it creates a disturbance?
It creates a disturbance, it creates damage. Absolutely.
In the spiritual realm.
Yes, in the spiritual realm. Which is why, you know, especially when we talk about speech, what is the most injurious speech to the fabric of the heavens? Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara creates actually a separation, it creates a tear in that connection between the physical realm and the spiritual realm. So that's why, and Lashon Hara is both in the specifics, which means speaking ill of another Jew, but also in the more general sense of any kind of negative energy that you create through speech, anytime you create what we call rechilos, anytime you create enmity or negative feelings about others, that also creates a tear in that very, very delicate connection between heaven and earth. So that's why it's very important to be able to avoid that. Because speech can be very, very powerful and can create many, many different things. And if it's true with speech, it's certainly true with physical behavior as well. So this is not something to be tampered with, is basically what Rabbi Yehuda Levi is saying. So that's why Moshe had difficulty understanding it, is that he couldn't really get his mind around until Hashem actually showed him that there really is a menorah in heaven that is ignited every time that you light a menorah down here. Okay, let's continue.
The same was true for the great temple which Shlomo built. David was shown the image on a spiritual plane, and the permanent temple which was promised us to be built in the future was shown to the prophet Yechezkel according to its shape and dimensions. When it comes to serving God, one cannot rely on logic, inference, or discretion. If that were the case, the philosophers, with their great wisdom and intellect, would have achieved far more than what Israel has already attained.
Okay. So he's basically stated that even the Beis HaMikdash, not only just the Mishkan, which was shown to Moshe, but the Beis HaMikdash was shown to David HaMelech, and the third temple, which we're awaiting to be built, was shown to Yechezkel in Yechezkel chapters 40 to 43, you see that God shows Yechezkel an image of what the future temple will look like. Now, why does Hashem show Yechezkel that image if this temple will not exist during Yechezkel's lifetime and Yechezkel has no responsibility for building it? Why should generations of Jews who will never see the third temple bother studying the dimensions of the third temple? The answer is because those dimensions itself, the knowledge of those dimensions, have a certain benefit for us to be able to internalize. Just like reading about the dimensions of the Mishkan, when we read about them in the Torah, they seem to have no bearing whatsoever upon us. But just the knowledge of those dimensions, we just need to take them into our minds and create an image in our minds of that Mishkan, and that in itself creates some kind of connection to the Mishkan that exists in heaven. So that's a part and parcel of what Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is describing over here. And then we've therefore understand why the Torah devotes so much time to the dimensions of the Mishkan, something which was a historical reality and only existed for a few hundred years in the history of the Jewish people. It existed for just a little bit over 400 years, the Mishkan. Okay? After that, it was destroyed. The Mishkan was destroyed by the Philistines, and it was never to be returned. There's a whole discussion in the Gemara whether the Mishkan will come back with the third temple or not. But if it never comes back, then why do we have to bother reading about it? We spend Parshas Truma, Parshas Tetzaveh, Parshas Vayakhel, Parshas Pekudei, part of Parshas Kitisa. Like we go through 4 or 5 weeks of Torah reading about stuff that is a historical event, a historical piece of architecture, which has absolutely no bearing on our lives. But au contraire, it does have bearing on our lives, and the knowledge of it, the understanding of this structure, even if we don't necessarily resonate with it on an intellectual level, but there's something about that knowledge of those dimensions that helps us relate to the already existent Mishkan that exists on a spiritual plane. And that's why he finishes off by saying that it's not about what makes sense to you. It's not about what is logical, because you don't need to know the reason why, or the doctor is going to operate, or what exactly the surgery is going to entail. The surgeon knows what the surgery is going to entail, and he tells you, I guarantee you, when you have this surgery, we'll solve the problem, we'll solve your medical issue. And you trust the doctor. The Torah says, Ani Hashem Rofe Echa, I am the Lord your healer. And therefore, Hashem prescribes these dimensions because they create a certain reality. And therefore, we study them because we want to connect with that reality. At the same time that he is criticizing the philosophers, I want you to observe that he's giving them a great compliment in this very last paragraph. It's almost like he's of two minds. On the one hand, he has tremendous respect for the wisdom of the philosophers of his time. And he basically says, they understand the world a lot better than we do, or basically than I do, he's saying. They understand, their understanding of the metaphysics and of the cosmos, their understanding of cosmology, their understanding of physics, of nature around us, does transcend in many ways my understanding of it. However, the one thing that they don't have is a directive from Hashem as to how to live their lives. They may understand the physical universe much better than I do, but what they fail to have is the way that this physical world connects with the spiritual world. And because they lack that, then no matter how much it may be logical to them to live a certain kind of lifestyle, no matter how much it may make sense from an intellectual standpoint, if you don't have the prescription from Hashem as to what exactly you need to do in order to be able to ameliorate the spiritual world, then what you're doing is not going to accomplish anything. And that's why he says they would have achieved far more than what Israel has already attained. Now, what has Israel attained? Israel has attained ultimate conjunction, connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We've achieved prophecy, we've achieved miracles, we've achieved the divine presence coming into our midst. That's all part of our history. Can the philosophers, even the ancient philosophers such as Plato and Aristotle, can they claim that kind of achievement of their philosophical communities? Have they been privy to miracles in the same way that the prophets that were even their contemporaries, such perhaps as Yirmiyahu, who was privy to miracles? Can they claim the same level of achievement? They can't, because he's going to come back to this many, many times throughout the Kuzari when we compare philosopher versus prophet. The prophet may not seem as sophisticated in his knowledge as a philosopher. The prophet may not even be as articulate in expressing his ideas as a philosopher. But the reason why that doesn't and shouldn't faze us is because the mind is not where it's at. Our mind is a very limited tool. So even if you achieve 100% maximum efficiency of your mind, of your intellect, you're still not tapping into the deeper secrets of the universe. The only way that you can tap into those deeper secrets is through Hashem's guidance of letting us know where it's at. There are certain things that the human mind simply cannot achieve, cannot attain, without the help of Hashem. And that's why the philosopher simply will never be able to, no matter how brilliant and how articulate he is, will never be able to attain the level of Klal Yisrael. Okay? Now, we're ready to embark on our next discussion, which starts with paragraph 100 on page 121. Let's just very briefly discuss the segue from this discussion, which talks about the specificity and the precision of Hashem's mitzvos, and the next discussion, which talks about the plausibility of God's giving us the Torah. Because essentially, if you just take a look at the first sentence of paragraph 100, the Kuzari said, one could comfortably accept the Torah without any doubt or hesitancy once the following were fulfilled. And now he's going to launch into an explanation of why there's a certain great plausibility that when we stood at Har Sinai, we actually heard God speak. What is the connection between the plausibility of Torah Misinai, of a Mosaic tradition that God gave us the Torah at Sinai, and the previous discussion of the great sense of purpose and precision in the giving of the mitzvahs? So I want you to think about that as we prepare to embark on this next discussion. What is the segue that connects up until now what we've been discussing and what we're about to launch into, which is to try and prove how it's extremely plausible to believe that God gave us the Torah? And when you think about that, and we'll pick that up with that next time, okay? Okay, we'll hold it here for today.